Lecture 14, Aristotle on the Perfect Life.
To offer a lecture, particularly a brief lecture on Aristotle on the perfect life, might be to mislead an audience into believing that Aristotle thought of himself as living such a life or as being able to supply the last word on that most intriguing and indeed elusive of questions, namely, how should I live my life? And in fact, in the ethical treatises that I mentioned in the previous lecture, the Nicomachean Ethics and the Eudaimonian Ethics, we actually get two rather different perfect lives as candidate perfect lives for one to live. In the course of this lecture, I'll go into those two possibilities. But I think we should rehearse some points raised in the previous lecture on the moral and intellectual virtues, because these are going to be foundational for considerations of the kind of life that it is worth our effort to try to live. The intellectual virtues possess, as a gift, so to speak, the power of our understanding the causes of things in the world. The intellectual virtues embrace scientific knowledge, episteme. It's the means by which we actually are knowing beings, and of course, absent a knowledge of ourselves and the world in which we live, the form of life cannot rise higher than a kind of animalistic form of life. So surely, a perfect life is going to be one that is guided by, and indeed directed toward, a scientific or systematic or developed knowledge, including self-knowledge. In its way, technion enters into this also, because there is an artistic dimension to the life worth living. We are, as it were, these are not Aristotle's words, but I think he'd quite concur, I'd like to think he'd quite concur, we are, as it were, artistic objects of a self-defining, self-creating nature, and the whole perfectionist scheme in Aristotle's ethics and psychology is the way of getting a set of potentialities realized ever more fully, to get, metaphorically speaking, to get a work of art ever more complete, just as the perfected friendship is an ever more complete and sympathetic relationship between persons who are comparable, relevantly comparable in virtue. The right kind of life also calls upon us to make the right kinds of choices. Not only must we act in the course of life, but we have to have good reasons for acting. We have to have good reasons in the sense that our actions have to be something other than merely reactions. In the previous lecture, I said that a chap who helps somebody gain his feet after falling, but does so as the result of post-hypnotic suggestion, is not described as a virtuous person, because the conduct in question is more by way of a reaction to hypnotic influence than it is by way of an agentic action by an intending person desiring to bring something about. Virtuous acts are performed by virtuous people. It's not just in the mechanics of the act that we find the virtue, it's in the character of the actor that we come to understand the action to be virtuous. Well, similarly, we want to find, if we're going to aspire to the right kind of life, we have to be able to make decisions based on good reasons. We've got to do what we do because we have a good reason for doing it. And this ability to articulate sound and defensible reasons for action is itself a form of wisdom. It's a form of knowledge, a kind of prudential knowledge for which the Greek word was phronesis. So as the philosophically wise man possesses something called sophia, the practically wise person possesses something called phronesis. And phronesis, in contrast to episteme, phronesis does have this practical daily life side to it. It's making the right kinds of choices and decisions because the calculative and rational powers have been deployed in such a way as to weigh the competing options, the competing possibilities, and understand the various consequences likely to attend one course of action versus another. Now, the right kind of life also finds us committing ourselves, committing our rational powers, our thought processes, our daydreams, our deepest reflections to what it is worth thinking about. And Aristotle, in his writings, does insist that when all is said and done, the right kind of life, to the extent that we're contemplating anything at all, is a life in which we are contemplating the best things, the things that are most worthy, not just contemplating anything. The very best. Timocracy is ruled by the most meritorious. So that which is of the highest merit, we should be contemplating that. That is, given a choice between contemplating issues of philosophical consequence or contemplating changes in the stock market, a more flourishing life is lived by the former contemplative person than by the latter contemplative person. It's not that there's anything wrong with spending one's time thinking about the stock market. It's that if that's all you're thinking about, then in fact you have reduced your ceiling to issues of that kind, which are transitory and culturally defined and episodic and all that. Now, why should we aspire to moral excellence at all? Why should we aspire to what in the previous lecture I referred to as the moral virtues? Why should one be courageous as opposed to being a coward? Why should one be temperate as opposed to being extreme? Why should one confine one's anger to a kind of noble anger and proportioned instead of being in a blind rage? Is the right answer to that question a utilitarian answer? Is it just that, if you do it that way, you get by better in the world? No, Aristotle says no. We've got to go back to Aristotle's theory of causation when we raise the question, why should we be a certain way? Because the answer then is going to be, well, what are the causes of our being a certain way? Now, when Aristotle raises this question, he serves up an answer that at first seems almost simplistic. He says, well, look, the question here is, why do people, if the question is, why should I live a virtuous life, or why should I try to be noble and so forth, this is just a special version of the general question, why do I do anything? Why does anybody do anything? Now, this is do things, not just react to things, not take one's hand off a hot object, but why do I, in the fullest sense of intending to do something, actually set about to do something with intentionality, ekousios, as opposed to akousios. I do it with full intention. Particularly, why do I do those things that involve a deliberated choice between alternatives? This deliberated choice in the Greek is, the Greek word for it is prohairesis. And we are said to have the power of deliberated choice. Why do I choose course of action A over course of action B? And I say the seemingly simplistic answer, the first approximation answer that Aristotle serves up is this. He says, well, look, people do what they do. If you ask people, why do you do what you do? You ask somebody, why are you going to the doctor? Well, I want to make sure that I'm in good health. I say, well, why do you want to be in good health? Well, if I'm not in good health, I probably won't be able to hold down my job, and I'm going to have aches and pains. Well, now, why is it that you want to hold down a job? Well, now, if you keep this going, if you keep this kind of questioning going, it obviously can't lead to an infinite regress. You can't. There's got to be a terminus ad quem. There's got to be some point where it no longer makes sense to ask, and why that? And so Aristotle says, well, what is the end toward which all of these other desiderata are steps along the way? What is that end for the sake of which we seek all these other things? And he answers that in a word. It's a word that lends itself to more than one translation and interpretation, and depending on how you do translate it, you can end up with theories rather removed, I should think, from Aristotle. The terminus ad quem, that for the sake of which we do all these other things, he says, is, in the Greek, eudaimonia. Well, so there's going to be much weight attached to how we render that term eudaimonia. Typical translations, eudaimonia as happiness. So everything we do for the sake of happiness. Now again, I don't want to cast either myself or Aristotle as H.L. Mencken's Puritan, you know, that line about the fear that someone somewhere may be happy. But certainly Aristotle's entire ethical philosophy, his whole treatise on friendship, expresses nothing but the gravest reservations about one whose behavior is guided chiefly by considerations of sensual pleasure. He singles out such a person in the Greek called an apolostikos. I mean, this is somebody who's really in deep trouble, where 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, this is the old brain in the vat thing. The whole point of life is drink up, let's have another round, you know. So he certainly cannot mean by eudaimonia that sort of thing. Well, what does he mean? He certainly doesn't mean what the psychologist Maslow would have in mind with the phrase peak emotional experience, as in whoopee, or now I see it, or hallelujah, brother. It's not that. I think the best rendering of eudaimonia is not that it's some point reached. It's not some ephemeral, our current state. It's a form of life. It's life of a certain character and stripe. And what character and stripe is it? Here I would say the right rendering of eudaimonia is flourishing. It is, that is, everything we do, ultimately we do, for the sake of a flourishing form of life, a eudaimonic form of life. Now that's not in opposition to happiness, but it gives happiness a certain coloration, a deep and lasting coloration, that the English word be happy doesn't quite convey. In fact, that the English word happy has a tendency to obscure. Well, then the question would be, how do we flourish? That is, if the goal of all of our actions ultimately is eudaimonia, then what indeed would eudaimonia be for us? And Aristotle here thinks that we're the only ones who can have this anyway. Animals, he said, non-human animals can have a kind of happiness, but it's a kind of happiness so inextricably bound up with creature comforts, avoidance of pain, food and drink, and the like, that it doesn't really quite make it. And in any case, it is not the outcome of a rationally deliberated choice. It's rather the outcome of instinctual things. Now, the grounds on which Aristotle would deny non-human animals eudaimonia, and by the way, would also deny very young children eudaimonia, and would deny madmen eudaimonia, the grounds are these. Eudaimonia presupposes a rational plan. It presupposes that what is being realized is a rational plan of life. So again, we find something different from what the apolostikos is seeking. We're finding instead what a rational being would seek as a form of life capable of realizing ever more fully what is the rich range of potentialities within a being of that kind. Well, all right, then, we still go back to the question, what will this eudaimonic form of life entail? And here, I say, Aristotle's major ethical works give us two choices. And scholars have debated for the longest time which of those choices was actually Aristotle's preferred choice. And I'm not quite sure that's the right question. I think the prior question is, did Aristotle have any ground on which to choose one over the other? Or was he left at the end of the day with a kind of hands up, here are the options, they're not entirely compatible with each other, and it's not quite clear that you can choose one over the other? Well, let's get to the two possibilities. We are rational beings. It's defining of our nature. What defines a fish is aquatic life. What defines a bird is flight. If you would ask yourself, now, granting that fish and birds, on Aristotle's account, cannot have a eudaimonic form of life, let's say for argument's sake that we pretend fish and birds could have a eudaimonic form of life. What would be most incompatible with eudaimonia for a bird? What would be most incompatible with a eudaimonic form of avian life would be for the bird to be stripped of the power of flight. Because the power of flight so defines the essential nature of a bird that to be stripped of that is to be stripped of the central identity of this creature. Similarly, the fish out of water. We have that expression, for goodness sake, I felt like a fish out of water, meaning I found myself in a setting so utterly incompatible with what I take to be my essential nature that I could not even be myself in a setting of that kind. Do you see? Well, what then would most frustrate possibilities for eudaimonia, given that the creature in question is man? Well, if you take as the defining attribute the essential nature of man, rationality, the capacity for reflective, abstract, rational thought, the contemplation of that which is greatest and best and most enduring, then clearly the eudaimonic form of life is a contemplative form of life. A eudaimonic life, then, is a life spent by one, devoted by one, to a contemplation of first things, things of first importance and greatest importance. Aristotle tells us that this life is very much like life on, quote, the Isle of the Blessed. He says this is a life lived very much like the life of the gods. And what he means by this is, look, what the gods don't do what they do out of necessity. The gods do what they do for the sheer pleasure of the doing of it. There aren't any contingent impositions on the gods. And if you can find a form of human life where what you do for the sheer pleasure of doing it, you do it for its own sake and not for the sake of anything else. Do you see, find that for the sake of which something else is done, and that would be the most fundamental thing. Well, if the contemplative life is engaged in, not because you'll earn more money, not because you'll have more sensual pleasure, not because you'll live longer, not because your stock options will be increased, but for the sheer cognitive and spiritual excitement and pleasure aroused in you and sustained in you by contemplative devotion to those things that matter most, that is a nearly divine kind of life. Oh, my. This is getting very close to taking the lotus position, living solely on pumpkin seeds and learning a mantra. I mean, this doesn't sound like the Aristotle who's spending all his time examining the cuttlefish and classifying the animal kingdom and examining scores and scores of constitutions and engaging in comparative politics and the like. Is this contemplative life a life of inactivity? Is it a kind of suspended animation? No, it's an active life. It's not contemplation, well, it's not contemplation in isolation, because man is by nature a social animal, by nature essentially a social and political animal, which means there could not be a eudaimonic form of life lived in isolation, lived beyond the law, beyond the heart, beyond the state. He says of that figure in Homer, that hearthless, stateless, lawless man, that this is someone who either rises above humanity or falls beneath it. This isn't a human being. It may be a god. A god doesn't need a hearth or a law or a state or anything like that. And it may be something subhuman. Human beings you find within the polis, at the hearth, obedient to the law. So even this contemplative life is a life lived in society and lived in the world. All right, all right. That's a street address, however. Lived with like-minded people, yes, perhaps. Does begin to sound like All Souls College, Oxford. So you hole up in there and pull down the shades and everyone lives a contemplative life. It sounds almost monastic in that sense. But I don't think, I'm not quite sure that Aristotle lands on that point. Now, there's yet another possibility developed in yet another ethical treatise. We are by nature social animals. We are by nature political animals. We have this very strong inclination to live in each other's company. We seek that most rewarding of personal relationships, friendship. Friendship by its nature is to be grounded in principle. There are at least several principles that might ground friendship. There's a pleasure principle. There's a utilitarian principle. And then there are principles of virtue. The principles of virtue at the individual level are like the principles of law that govern the political... Now, wait a minute. There are some possibilities being worked out here. Let's say that the just state, the state whose laws are just, is the state that requires, through the force and power and authority of law, that we behave the way the man of virtue would behave habitually and by nature anyway. That is to say, the law may require all of us to do what a rational being, at his best, would be doing by choice. And by conditioning us to behave this way, that is, with the force of law requiring us to develop lawful habits, well, then the force of law and the rule of law conduces us to a virtuous form of conduct. Now, of course, in conducing us to a virtuous form of conduct, it renders us ever more fit, not merely for life within the polis, it renders us ever more fit for friendships of a certain kind. It renders us ever more fit for the most rewarding of interpersonal experiences and the flourishing life that becomes possible thereby. Well, now, what would be the best form of life one could live, understood now in those terms? Well, the best form of life, the eudaimonic outcome, given all that, would be the life of the good lawgiver. It would be the life of the person immersed in the political needs and realities of his time and contributing to the polis through legislative activity, through his own virtuous conduct, contributing in such a way that the state, like the person, do you see, that the state perfects itself, and it perfects itself by regulating itself ever more consistently with the principles and tenets of reason, proportionality, prudence, balance, harmony, fitness, aptness. Remember, the Greek word for fitness, for hand in glove, is harmonia. Not the word for the musical version would be melodia. But harmony here is something that's not simply acoustic. It's something apt or fit and right. It's a product of reason and reason and reasonable calculations. We go to the doctor for the sake of preserving health. We go to the law for the purpose of securing a reasonable, prudent, balanced, harmonious form of life. We go to the law. The law attaches, it attracts us. We attach our fidelity to it, not simply because it threatens us with a whip and a chair. That's the wrong model of the law. That's the law as a tyranny. Aristotle sees the law very much the way he sees the rule of reason. He calls the rule of reason a royal rule, a princely rule. It inclines. It doesn't determine, do you see? It's not a tyrannical rule. It's a princely rule. It's the rule set by good example. The law is supposed to function in the same way. When he describes the law as philikon, this friendly characteristic of the law, we see in the law something of what we see in the good friend. As I said in the previous lecture, the good law, the rule of justice, the regime of justice, is calling upon us to do the things that make us better. It's not so much threatening us with punishment as it is holding out possibilities, the possibilities imminent in a reasonable and decent form of life. Now, how do we broker what seem to be the competing claims of a life of political activity as lawgiver, as citizen, as representative and leader of the polis, and the contemplative life of the wise man who, as if he were on the Isle of the Blessed, is engaged in deep thought on first things for the sake of the thought itself and not for the sake of anything else? Well, I want to give you a matter-of-fact, unequivocal, non-philosophical, almost doctrinaire answer to that question once and for all so that we never have to deal with it again. I don't think you can broker the competing claims of these two possibilities. I don't think Aristotle thought so either, and I don't think we ever will. There is a fundamental tension between a life of activity and a life of contemplation. There isn't any way around it at all. Once a scholar decides to devote himself or herself to a life of study, trying to get things right, and recognizing that by nature we are fallible beings, it almost becomes impossible to take decisive action at the daily political level of decision-making, industrial, corporate, bureaucratic life. Do I support this government policy? What do I say about the neighbor's loud music and rotten lawn, etc., etc.? Because after all, well, on a certain construal, well, if you look at it this way, well, if you interpret it through the eyes of the... So this is the Hamletian life of the disinterested scholar who recognizes that he may always. The contemplative life, really, as the Hindus earlier recognized, and as Buddhists recognize, the contemplative life is a contemplative life. And it is a life that, by its very nature, must remove one from the day-to-day affairs of the world. The life of Pericles, the life of any great political leader, the life of the great lawgiver, is a life not just of activity. Oh, of course, Aristotle understands that contemplation is activity. It's surely activity. It's not a trance state. But the political leader is changing the world, and the political leader very often is changing the world with his hands. He's changing the world with military force, with currency, with enacted legislation that carries heavy penalties for defiance, trade agreements, rhetoric, propaganda, marshaling the resources of the community with threats and praise and artifices, recruiting the dramatists and musicians and painters and sculptors so that art can be used for rhetorical purposes. Great things can be brought about. You know who's on the horizon, don't you? All of the resources of the Hellenistic world are going to be pulled together by Alexander the Great and are going to be used for the express purpose of Hellenizing the world. This is a chap that Aristotle had an opportunity to teach for a while. Here's Alexander the Great. If you want a model of the man of practical affairs, you couldn't ask for anybody better than this. King of the Roost. How do we Hellenize the world? Well, we do it in every way we can. And by the way, all you troops, marry those Persian women. That'll help too. Now, of course, by the time Alexander the Great came back from his conquests, he's dressed in Persian quasi-divine regalia, and he's got a crown on, and the Athenians are howling in the street. So I'm not quite sure that he certainly Hellenized much of the world, but he also transformed himself to a considerable extent. But that's the man of practical affairs. And Aristotle has great, great respect for such people. He's got Alexander's troops sending back animal specimens from known parts of the world. He's doing comparative anatomy and ethology and the like. And he's a great supporter, at least for a time, of what Alexander the Great is up to. That's not the contemplative life. Aristotle's own Lyceum is not a life lived by purely contemplative people. The analysis, the separate analysis of different constitutions, Aristotle's founding of comparative politics, do you see, comparative jurisprudence, is for the sake of determining how different parts of the world should be dealt with, how the law is understood in these places. We have every reason to believe that the products of that education are going to... In fact, Alexander the Great allegedly was very worried about this. He writes one letter, we are told, to Aristotle, say, hey, aren't you giving away too many of our secrets? Aren't you letting potential enemies know too much about how we solve these problems? So, what sort of life is right for us? Is philosophy to answer that question? And if it can't answer that question, why do we bother reading it at all, except to seem alert and chirpy at fashionable parties? Well, I think if we stay with Aristotle for a moment, the answer to the question is that the right form of life for us is probably not something that can be nailed down once and for all. It certainly is going to include a rich component of deeply contemplative activity for the sake of coming to grips with the possibilities imminent in our very rational nature. But it is also a life to be lived among fellow human beings and the balance of creation, a life that respects the beauty and order of the cosmos and commits no crimes or sins against it, a life of proportion, a life that is guided by phronesis, a life of prudence, a life in which the passions are reined in, and a life that, after all, as Homer taught and as every ancient Greek knew, is a mortal life. And eudaimonia, if it's to be reached at all as a form of life, must always be a temporary state of affairs for that two-legged creature that eats of nature's dainty and takes alternate labor and repose at the crystal fountain. Thank you.